Hello and welcome to the Land and Climate Podcast. My name's Bertie Harrison-Brudinski, and today I'm talking to Austin Frerich, an expert in agricultural and competition policy in the US. He's a fellow of Yale University's Thurman Arnold Project and has advised or worked for senior Democratic Party figures such as Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg, and President Biden on antitrust and farming policy. I'm going to be talking to him today about his new book, called Barons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry.
Iowa has about 25 million hogs. Keep in mind, a hog defecates three times more than a human being, so we're talking the manure of 75 million people. That's like the equivalent of like Texas and California combined, whereas at the same time, that regulatory structure has collapsed.
Austin has said that Barons was inspired by witnessing just how industrialized farming and land had become in his home state of Iowa. So I began by asking when and why he started working on the book.
I mean, it was a combination of just trying to grapple with what happened to my home as I got older, of like, it all kind of fell apart. Why is everyone so angry? And then it honestly started, like most good things, in a dive bar conversation. I was just BSing with someone, a political operative, and they told me how there's no campaign contribution limits for state level races. So he was telling me how this one hog farmer had donated $300,000 to the governor for her campaign, and how it's a private jet and supposedly ridden on the jet is when pigs fly. So part of me in my head right away was like, oh, that's good copy. But then the other part of me, like the academic part of my brain, was like, what's going on here? Like, how did a hog farmer have his own jet? Which led me to kind of, you know, start looking into it. And then you realize industrial implies efficiency, and this model is not efficient at all. It's just the shifting of cost burdens. What I realized writing that first piece about a hog baron in Iowa is a lot of people assume that this model, oh, this was a natural technology advancement, efficiency, whatever. And you realize, no, this baron corrupted the political system for his economic advantage. And a lot of corners were cut. And what I realized in my research too is most, you become a baron because you're willing to cross ethical lines other people aren't willing to cross. Like most farmers are not willing to. Anyone that's ever raised hogs knows how incredibly social they are. Most of them aren't willing to stuff them into a metal shed where they never see a blade of grass or, you know, the sunlight.
To go back to that point about campaign contributions that started you off on this, I mean, to what extent is state capture? And I think you used that phrase once or in some circumstances in the book. I mean, is that at the root of the problem here? We had a reporter from Lighthouse Reports on a few months ago talking about some investigations they've been doing in the EU into agricultural lobbying. And I feel like there are some similarities in that a lot of what they're looking at is about the way that big unions don't actually represent the accurate views of most farmers, even if those larger interests represent a large portion of the kind of profits within the industry. I was just interested to ask you, I mean, the extent to which you feel like that this is actual corruption, is this kind of worse than other sectors?
Yeah, it's worse than other sectors. I mean, I think part of it reflects the state of American media right now. I was able to write and tell the history of the hog baron because I always have this great paper, the Des Moines Register. I mean, they had a whole section on agriculture news, a whole team of reporters. That's all gone. To my knowledge, there's only one reporter in the whole entire state now who is beat is agriculture. And that person generally tends to copy-paste industry talking points. So you have to start with the notion of so many of these abuses and what's going on has just, these stories aren't being told. And the only newspapers really left in America now are these elite, you know, white-collar coastal papers. And they tend to be more obsessed with, like, what's the it new restaurant than, like, what's actually going on most people's plates. To me, every baron is a good example of state capture. And the one I think about a lot is actually Cargill. I thought they were the most brilliant in terms of their state capture in that. I mean, when I originally put this book proposal together, they weren't in the plan. I mean, I didn't really know much about them, but they're the largest private company in America. I mean, that's wild. They're bigger than the Coke industry. They're able to fly under the radar because they use this, what I call the middleman strategy. They give money to other groups and let them do their bidding. So that way they can kind of keep their hands clean. When I first started writing that chapter, I compared to them closest thing we have to a modern day Standard Oil in terms of they own the middle, they own the rails. That's their goal. They're not consumer facing. You don't see anything with like Cargill's name on it. Their whole goal is to capture everything from the movement of grain and its processing. And when we see moments of their abuses, it's incredible. It's very dark. The example I include that chapter is I reference an FT Financial Times investigation where I believe it was Ecuador or Colombia. I'm sorry, I can't remember which one off the top of my head. But, you know, it was a country that went through a massive civil war. A lot of it was rooted in land holdings. And part of, you know, rebuilding after the civil war was limiting land ownership. And then it comes out that Cargill secretly blew past that rule by like 35x to a massive land holding in the country. And it's just like, if you see that one little example, you just know that this is just the tip of the iceberg.
I think it was Colombia. And as well as that, I mean, maybe it would be nice to do a bit of the storytelling profiling for our listeners. Could you talk us through Cargill and how that did arise?
So my family's like Irish potato famine people, come to Iowa. They farmed right near, like literally 17 miles up the road from where Cargill was founded in Iowa. And Cargill was just a classic grain storage company. And, you know, they're like in the other like family business where, you know, they slowly buy a few grain elevators. But their big thing was they really grew during the New Deal and they slowly started buying more and more companies. And it wasn't just about, you know, owning grain elevators. They wanted to, like, you know, move it down the Mississippi, all that kind of stuff. And you just see this company turbocharge. And I use their story to also tell this bigger story. What is the farm bill in America? Where at the end of the day, because Cargill is a grain company, it always wants overproduction of grain. It wants to pay the least amount as possible and it wants to move as much as possible. But that's an inherent tension with the original New Deal farm bill, because the New Deal farm bill was supply management. How do we like figure out the sweet spot of production, do a little bit of limiting of production, put caps on stuff? So from the get-go, the Cargill family hated the New Deal farm bill. So what you see is they slowly, systematically assault it or try to deconstruct it, defang it, whatever word you want to use, to what I call the 1996 farm bill, the Wall Street farm bill, where you see a fundamental shift in America's farm bill, where now it's designed to overproduce a few things, mainly grains. You know, either we just waste it in our cars with ethanol, we use it as industrial animal feed, we use it for highly processed foods, which is what Cargill want. On the flip side, what that means is relatively fresh, healthy food has gotten more expensive. And a lot of that's moved offshore too. And so I kind of tell that story of the result of this model is, you know, you have it contributed to the obesity crisis in America right now.
It'd be interesting to talk about what other kind of key moments in the timeline of this industry progressing in the way that you've documented might be. And you talk about NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, in some chapters too. Is that maybe the key other piece of legislation?
There's two other key things. So NAFTA is one. There was these little moments that came along, but I want to focus on a piece that really symbolizes like a shift, a policy shift. And NAFTA, when you basically engage in free trade and food production will shift to the place where it can abuse labor and environmental protections the most. Let's just be frank. It's like a t-shirt. I was originally going to use the Berry Company Driscoll's to tell the story of the farm bill. And when I realized, no, I really need to tell the story of the offshoring of the American produce system really hasn't been told. And I want to use the story of Driscoll's to tell that. And NAFTA really encapsulates that, where, you know, Driscoll sells 1 in 3 berries in America, but they don't grow a single berry. they own the IP. And then they contract out the production in a production model that's very similar to sharecropping from the American South. You see modern day plantations in developing countries where you have 12-year-olds working for pennies on the day, massive environmental abuses. Like a lot of American berries are grown in Baja, California. That area is just as dry as Death Valley. So they drain the aquifers, then they build a desalinization plant on the ocean to provide water. Barely any people lived there before this model took hold. And now they brought in a lot of indigenous people. It's so hard to report, especially the state of American media. So you see stories of abuse here and there, but you just know you're getting the tip of the iceberg. And then the other big, to me, philosophical shift in this book is the election of Reagan and what that meant for how America views its antitrust laws, its like anti-monopoly framework. And basically, it just collapsed with the election of Reagan. It became a pro-monopoly framework that allowed to massive consolidations of power in the food system. Companies like Cargill were able to essentially go on a buying spree because they could, because the safeguards were gone.
So a lot of the key moments in this are 80s and 90s, really. What's happened since then and where do you see things trending now?
Rural America has become an extraction colony, especially in the Midwest. You know, my hog baron does 5 million hogs a year. I mean, that family farm died in my lifetime. 1 in 10 Americans work in the food system. We've seen those wages collapse. for every dollar you spend in the grocery store, what a farmer gets is at a record low. I mean, you can keep going on the list, environmental destruction, all this stuff. The only person who's benefited under this model are the barons. They captured all the gain, and we all have to live with the societal consequences of their destruction.
In Western Europe, at least, if not elsewhere, you've, in fact, also in parts of Asia, lots of parts of the world, you have quite active discussions, both in academia, media, and policymakers now about changing farming systems for climate strategies. How is that tied up in all of this in the US? I mean, do you see this kind of timeline that you've just explained for us hitting a sudden corner with climate mitigation policy or not? Or how does it interact?
I mean, America has this internal time bomb it's dealing with where its aggressive move to electric vehicles means ethanol is going to die. The single largest use now of corn in America is ethanol. I mean, we burn in our cars. It's a farce. It's a joke. It's a waste of the best farmland in the world. But that's going to be a radical shift as cars move to EVs. That market will collapse. So what's going to happen? At the same time, too, you're right. I mean, there's this, especially for the last few years, this fascinating tension between Western Europe and America over its farm policy. You see with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, it understands climate change is happening, but it doesn't want to actually grapple with anything. So all of its solutions are a farce. It's a joke. Still is a joke. It still thinks it can overproduce and engage in these really destructive models and then just paper over it. Whereas Europe understand, as an American looking out, Europe seems to be going in this more sustainable regenerative model that just understands the bigger picture. But I mean, the war in Ukraine stuff just really threw a wrench into things. But I naively thought when it happened that ethanol would die actually faster in America because it's like Ukraine's such a large grain production region. When you take that much land out of production, you're just asking for global instability from rising food prices. Not only did that not happen in America, we doubled, like the Biden administration's doubled down on ethanol. And so it's like, oh yeah, it's so clear. That's why all these the global increases in food prices is because you have an old-fashioned European land war coupled with ethanol. But then like even in North America, you're seeing this model like really break down or the tension starting to boil to the surface where Mexico is kind of done with America dumping its overproduced corn onto its markets. At the same time, too, Canada is pushing back. It has a supply management dairy system that tries to preserve, to some degree, family dairy farms, whereas America just wants to dump our overproduced, you know, ice cream and cheese on their markets and basically put those families out of business. And you're seeing that tension play up, too. So this whole NAFTA thing is breaking down, too, because it's just caused so much destruction, and you're just seeing countries push back now. I don't think this tension has been really appreciated in bigger news outlets. It's kind of been below the surface.
There's a bit of a deglobalization trend happening at the moment. I know with tech and with the US and China, there seem to be supply chains that are becoming a bit more autarkic, a bit less multinational than they used to be in agriculture. It sounds like you think maybe there are elements of that kind of happening as well.
That's what climate change requires. Why are you wasting that much energy, fossil fuels, to ship organic juice from Turkey to America? Like you're just shipping water halfway across the world when you can literally grow apple juice or whatever anywhere. To me, the undercurrent too of these globalized supply chains, besides being fragile in agriculture, is they taste awful. You know, when your berry is grown in Chile to be sold in New York City, that berry is not engineered for taste, it's engineered for durability. And so like the undercurrent of all this is it just makes a really poor tasting food system. Like you're paying more for less quality.
The other element with climate change is, of course, like adaptation and risk from changing weather and drought and all of these things. And a lot of what you're writing about in the book does relate to water systems. And I mean, I think if I remember rightly, you talk about large new livestock developments being planned on floodplains in Iowa and the extent to which California, I think it is in your book, where you're talking about the over-reliance on irrigation systems because it's too dry naturally. Surely some of these things are going to reach breaking point in our lifetimes, I would have thought. Do you see any awareness of that within the industry or government or planning for it?
To me, it reflects the bigger Wall Street mentality of this, the short-termism we see in Wall Street being reflected now in the food system. I mean, you have so much massive dairy production going on, like the Texas Panhandle. And you're like, that was the heart of the Dust Bowl. Dairy cows are incredibly thirsty. Why are you doing intensive dairy production there? But it's like no one's thinking, the person running a 5,000 cow operation there, they're not farmers, they're capital asset managers, and they're just trying to make a 5-10 year return. They don't care what happens to the aquifer after it. They don't usually live there. They usually live in suburban Dallas. To me, it's part of the disconnect with consolidation is the people actually doing the farming and who own the assets are two different things. Like, take my dairy baron. My dairy baron is part of a 35,000 cow operation in Northwest Indiana. He presents himself as a farmer, but to me, he's just a capital asset manager. And I even talk about in my book how he claims residency at the Ritz-Carlton in Puerto Rico for tax advantages. The undercurrent is in most industrial dairies, they're run by undocumented men. A lot of them used to be farmers in Central America. So it's like, they're the actual farmers here. I mean, most of these barons, you know, they're just Wall Street types. But I mean, that's like this weird cosplay you see going on in the system and that weird disconnect.
Just going back to this point a little bit about conversations outside of America and in America too, but maybe even if not at governmental level, about new forms of farming or reforming farming systems for climate change in perhaps more radical ways. I mean, did you find yourself drifting towards any of those models or having strong views on which new systems might work best, especially ones that might appeal to all audiences in the same way?
Number one, I think the best way to politically sell this and actually drive supply change is procurement. Who doesn't want good, healthy, local food served in your local school district? I mean, that's such an easy political sell in America. Food grown organically, you pick your model. That is such an easy sell. Also, I'm more focused in my solutions about attacking the power structures that have hindered reform, because to me, everything you eat is subsidized. The question is over the degree of what, and right now it's so tilted one way that you're just playing on the margins if you're trying to like do anything else on the other. And so to me, it's like, you got to go after that structure. Then I go after these promotional agencies called checkoffs in the USDA that really, we're talking about basically a tax on farmers that's used to promote their good. Famously in America, the Got Milk campaign was paid for this. We're talking about like $1 billion a year. Most of it's dairies. Dairy is like 600 million. This essential tax basically used to be used to advertise a good. Now I argue it's basically used to corrupt the academy, where so much of the junk science used for climate change and agriculture is being financed out of these checkoffs. A lot of these checkoffs, they control a lot of the news ecosystem in agriculture in America. So that's why I really focus on attacking that and dealing with it, because any reformer, anyone pushing for these more pro-climate things, you're just going up against a $1 billion engine that can outlast you, or like, you know what I mean, just has so much resources to rain down on you. And so to me, I generally like to play offensive on the offense. And so I rather focus on taking down these two structures. So then whatever model may be can like rise. But to me, that model can't rise unless we deal with these corrupted structures.
Yeah. And in your conclusion, again, where you kind of set out very explicitly some of the things you think need to happen, a lot of that's focused on kind of pro-competition, anti-monopoly law as well, right?
Yeah, because I mean, I had such an aha, simple moment writing this book where I was sitting in a business school class at Yale and I realized, oh, the goal of every corporate executive is monopoly. That's where profits are. Like, you don't want competitive markets. Like, so you inherently have a tension between government that wants competitive markets and business that doesn't. And that, to me, is like the true folly of neoliberalism, is like, there's no such thing as a win-win there. It's like this naiveness to power. Barons want to break the system. They want to corrupt markets. That's to their economic interest. And if you take Econ 101, people behave in their economic interest. It was so obvious. To me, the story of this era is the inability for government to put up protections. It let these barons capture these markets, corrupt them, corrode them, what have you. And so tackling that. And also, like, I spent a lot of time on my conclusion, because there's nothing worse for me personally when I read a book telling me about how broken something is and they don't offer like realistic solutions of what we do here. And so I really wanted to illustrate that, but also give people hope, because I just get the sense, I mean, especially with the American election this year, how grim everything is, that people crave a positive vision of what the food system could be.
When I talk about some of these, or at least similar kind of structural issues with people about different sectors, often the solutions are like, make products that can last for longer, that we can repair, that we can reuse, all of this kind of thing. Clearly, that's a bit different when it comes to food. And a lot of the counter arguments that people in the climate sector often hear is like, oh, well, population growth is such that now you need to produce things in this way in order to be able to feed everyone. We couldn't go organic because there wouldn't be enough food, or we'd need intensive livestock production. Did you have conversations like that with anyone, come to any conclusions?
Most of those people are on checkoff dollars. They're paid to say that. And a lot of these people in the same sentence will say how great ethanol is. Like, if you really cared about that, why don't you oppose ethanol? One of my favorite academic papers I reference in my book was by a former journalist turned young antitrust lawyer, and how she investigated how in agriculture economics, there's these disclosure policies that are not enforced. So you have all these people writing basically who work, takes tons of industry money, and then they write, just so happens they write a lot of academic papers that are in the interests of industry and don't disclose it. And it's rampant. And these people are incredibly powerful because, like, for the layperson in the public square, when you see someone being cited who's the Iowa State tenured chair endowed of hogs, you're going to trust them. You don't realize how much shenanigans are going on behind the scenes. I'm not going to dismiss something out the gate. That's just, let's take ethanol out of production. Like, let's start, just move things in this direction and we'll figure it out as we go. But to just write it off from the get-go, it's just like, oh, you're just a hack. I don't really care what you have to say. Like, I want to live in a world that my grandkids can live in. So I'm gonna get done what I gotta get done.
So you've mentioned briefly kind of campaign contributions and maybe research that's funded by industry. Could you talk a little bit more about the methods by which this lobbying, for lack of a better word, happens, or state capture happens? And just back on this point again about kind of the US versus Europe, I mean, do you think the US is in a particularly bad situation with that? And is that threatening climate policy in the US?
I always have to start. I mean, the collapse of the regulatory framework for campaign contributions because of the US Supreme Court means you just don't know what's going on. I mean, with the creation of these super PACs, you don't know where the money's coming from and you don't know how it's being spent. People don't realize what's financing certain things. You'll see once in a while it comes to light where, like, you know, Cargill secretly financing entities that say how great corn syrup is or it's not bad for obesity. The Walmart family talked, they're my grocery baron, how they talked a big game about not supporting politicians who gave January 6th, and then they give a ton of money within a year to those same people. I just assume it by default, the state capture and just how much it's corrupting. This is what happens when you have concentrated economic power. I mean, I talk about this in my Coffee Baron chapter, because that chapter is really about monopoly. And Louis Brandeis, who really shaped the Supreme Court justice, who really shaped America's antitrust laws going back a century ago, I mean, that was his like core belief of just concentrated capital always corrupts the political system to the detriment of everybody. To me, my framework, like my solutions framework, is you have to deconcentrate power because it's just inherently bad. Even in the climate space, you're seeing a lot of money sloshing around by industry where it's not overtly corrupting, but it just neuters people where they don't want to rock the boat. They don't want to offend a funder. I mean, one little example kind of adjacent is in the lefty food reform space in America, Walmart family secretly finances a lot of people. And that is because Walmart really cares about food security, which is just an indirect way of really caring about food stamps, because so much of Walmart's clientele and employees need food stamps in America that it's financing that ecosystem. And what I've seen personally and internally is it neuters a lot of people from calling out Walmart, like, you're the richest family in the world. Why can't you pay your employees more so we have to spend less on food stamps? So, I mean, that's how this stuff plays out. There's so much unknown or like unseen that will never really come to light of day, or even it shapes the options. But to me, I always go back to, you just want to avoid concentrations of power and you want to deconcentrate power always.
Do you anticipate any backlash from any of these parties?
Yeah, you have to assume so when you write a book like this, when you disclose that. I mean, like, my dairy baron was a finalist to be named President Trump's Secretary of Agriculture, and he's in the running again. He doesn't want people to know that he claims residency at the port, you know, Ritz-Carlton, Puerto Rico. That's not part of the image he's selling. I mean, I have nearly 1,000 citations, I mean, footnotes in my book, because if you're going to write a book like this, you got to cross your T's, dot your I's. And this thing's been fact checked up the wazoo. And I mean, I'm also personally of the opinion where, I mean, America's dancing around a second term of Trump, and that is a whole can of worms that to me is, if not now, then when? Like, why not write a book like this now? America's on the precipice of a really dark moment. And so I'd rather just speak my truth and then, you know, my conscience is clean.
Specifically for the issues in your book around monopoly, around agricultural systems, what do you think's at stake with the election? Have you heard anything positive from the Biden camp? I noticed that I think I'm right in saying that generally in your analysis in the book, you don't lay blame at a particular party. I know you talked about Reagan earlier, but generally there are quite a few references to how both parties have followed certain trends.
And I think that's why people, it's hitting in a bipartisan way of just, it takes two to tango here. One party clearly contributed more to this model than the other, but you had certain Tony Blair type figures who really could add fuel to the fire. For me, the Biden administration, I really laid the blame at Secretary Vilsack. I think he really undermined the president's vision and also the president's re-election campaign, where he's a former industrial dairy lobbyist, and all his behavior just reflects someone who wants to be a lobbyist again, where you've had so much chatter. And one of the best bipartisan examples I've seen in recent history in American politics are reforming the meat markets in America. And instead of doing anything meaningful, the markets have actually gotten more concentrated these last 4 years. I mean, it's depressing. It's depressing, and like, what a lost opportunity to do something that, like, in the American history textbooks in grade school, when people talk about monopoly, meat monopoly is like the one people usually talk about. And they talk about, here's one industry that was monopolized that we fixed. And the fact that 100 years later, we can't do the same thing, copy paste, to me, it's a good example of this awful mix of incompetency and corruption at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We know what to do here. We can make people that work in the food system, we can elevate this, treat them with the respect and dignity and care they deserve. Because, I mean, that to me is an undercurrent of neoliberalism. It's just stripped off a lot of us of our humanity. And I think people, they know, that's usually why they like a small business, a small restaurant, because they're just a sense of human decency there that a lot of chains are missing. And so that to me is like the hope of this book is what the system could be. And I think people really, there hasn't been a positive vision articulated, especially for rural America. And so that's the void I'm hoping to fill here. But it's also convincing people, your listeners and policymakers, that, you know, using your personal fork doesn't change systems. We got to change systems. We got to change structures, change systems.
My thanks to Austin Frerich for coming on the show, and to Vasco Kostovsky for our audio engineering. Barron's is out now, and we'll link to it in the podcast blurb. And do remember, you can always find more articles and podcasts on our site at landclimate.org. Please do follow or subscribe and leave a review on your preferred podcast platform. We really appreciate it, and we'll see you again in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.